Welcome to Let's Talk Legal, part of Coastal Daybreak every Tuesday morning and brought to you by Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. You can call in now to have your legal questions answered by attorneys Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. Call in now with your questions at 252-247-7282.
You can join us right now with your legal questions, and Wes Collins is in the studio with us. Good morning, Wes. How are you?
Good morning, Ben. I'm doing great.
We were talking basketball earlier, yeah. You know?
Yeah, your son's doing a good job with the middle school team. It's awesome.
It's fun watching him coach.
Yeah. Hey, Duke lost last night to Syracuse.
I know. I know. As the ACC, eats the junk.
Now everybody's going to zone up Duke because that's all Syracuse did. Played the zone, made him shoot. But anyway, let's move on to legal topics,
I guess. All right, what are we talking about today?
Ben, we've been doing this program for 15 years, long time.
Well, and watching your kid play basketball, I remember when your kid was born.
He's almost 14. that's my yardstick for how long we've been doing the program. Mm-hmm. But a topic that came to mind for me is, kind of came to mind recently. I've been trying a couple cases here lately, jury cases.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we've ever talked about the actual procedure in a jury trial.
Oh, okay.
Plaintiff's attorney, defense attorney, directed verdict, opening, closing, cross-examination, and how that actually works.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and how different it is from what we see on TV.
Absolutely, absolutely. So what we have talked about a lot on the program over the years is kind of getting ready for the trial. We've talked about the discovery process, and we've talked about the pre-trial motions or the motions during discovery,
mm-hmm.
like motions to compel discovery or summary judgment motions or all these kind of things. And we've talked about the fact, that what this does is over time it kind of funnels the issues into something that's a little more narrow.
Right.
So before you get to trial, when you're right there about to try the case, in most cases, when you're trying a jury trial, the judge will want you to put together a pre-trial order.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the first thing. And what that is, basically, is any stipulations, things that we can agree to.
Okay.
Like if there's certain issues that we acknowledge.
We know this contract was signed on this day.
Yeah. We don't have to put on evidence of mm-hmm. whatever that is.
Mm-hmm.
We acknowledge that these medical records are authentic, for mm-hmm. example. That way we don't have to have the records custodian from all of the different medical providers come in and authenticate them.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Just stuff like that to kind of get rid of the fluff and let's get down to business.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes attorneys can't stipulate on things, but you need to know that in advance, you mm-hmm. know, as the attorney, and you have to, do what's necessary so that you can prove all elements of your case, such as the authentication of documents.
Mm-hmm. Something you stipulate on the behalf of your client?
Right.
So,
that's right. You stipulate on behalf of your client, and you don't have a stipulation unless everybody agrees to it. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, we're communicating weeks, months in advance about things that we may or may not be able to agree to, because that might make a difference about what we need to go do. For example, let's say that we can't come to an agreement about the authentication of certain records. Well, that may mean that I need to go take a DeBene essay or video deposition of someone to put on before the jury to authenticate certain records.
Mm-hmm.
Or I might need to make arrangements to have certain witnesses there. I need to get those subpoenas together and get those out so that I'm certain to have those witnesses there.
Right.
So, that kind of stuff. So the pretrial order also includes things like each side's list of witnesses,
mm-hmm.
list of exhibits, and issues. So it really, again, kind of boxes you in as well as it relates to what your case is going to be about. If you're in a position where you forget, which knock on wood, never has happened, and we make sure it doesn't happen, but if you forget to name a witness or if you forget to name an exhibit, on your pretrial order, then you're stuck with what you've got. So
mm-hmm.
you got to really think through your case and make sure that you're covering all of the things you'll need to cover to prove the issues that are in the case. Then lastly, the issues. What are the issues?
So that's all in the pretrial order.
All in the pretrial order. But the issues are not necessarily stipulated to. You might have the plaintiff's attorney saying, this is what I contend the issues
mm-hmm.
are, and then defense attorney saying, this is what I contend the issues are. Well, the judge eventually makes a determination after after hearing all the evidence, what issues are submitted to the jury. So kind of getting into the weeds there a little bit with regard to a pretrial order, but it's important to recognize that that's done pretty early on.
I think a lot of people never heard of that.
That's right. And it gets things kind of organized for the trial. So there's not surprises. So we know what's going on here, what evidence we're likely going to hear. And just because you name a witness, for example, on your pretrial order doesn't mean you have to call them. It's just that you have to identify them. Other things at the beginning.
There could be a little gamesmanship in that too.
No doubt there's gamesmanship. There's no doubt, you know, kind of catching the other side, trying to catch them off guard. So you have to anticipate pretty broadly, you know, what the other side might do, and be prepared for what they might do. Other thing that oftentimes takes place before you really ever get into the actual trial itself is, motions in limine. This is like a motion to keep out certain evidence.
Right.
For example, one of the motions in limine that we had in the trial did right before Christmas was on the dead man statute. You know, I try a lot of cases that are fiduciary related cases. They're maybe someone challenging a will or challenging a trust or bringing an action indicating, you know, alleging that the power of attorney or the attorney in fact under the power of attorney breached their duty. And in many cases, we're dealing with someone who's passed away.
Right.
And so there's somewhat of a fight maybe over the estate. Mm-hmm. Okay. So one of the issues you deal with in those type cases in many of these trials is the dead man statute. And basically what that indicates in North Carolina is that if you're an interested party, you can't come to court and testify about what someone who is deceased said if it goes to issues such as if it goes to issues that would basically improve your position.
Sure. Okay. Sure. Because it's hearsay for one thing, but then
right.
Yeah.
The hearsay is a different there's a different analysis there, but the threshold question there in many cases is, you know, does this dead man statute apply? So in the motion in limine, you know, you argue the dead man statute, and, you know, we identify who can testify, who can't testify about what the deceased said. But usually that's pretty clear. I mean, if you're going to receive anything through the will or through the trust or benefit in any way, and in many cases you're going to be a party or a family member of a party, if you're in a situation where the dead man statute applies. When I say a party, that means someone who's in the lawsuit.
Yeah.
That means plaintiff defendant, for example, caveator, propounder, that type of thing. So you got a lot of this pretrial stuff going on, making sure we know where we are, limiting evidence. Now, also as it relates to a motion in limine, you don't have to bring up everything that you don't think should come in your motion in limine. The motion in limine is a, you know, evidentiary motion. It's judge, this evidence can't come in, this is why. Okay? But you also have the right to object through the trial. And object and approach the bench and then make your argument with regard to why the particular evidence may or may not come in. And there's a little bit of, as you say, gamesmanship or strategy with regard to that. You know, some things we don't want anyone to utter them whatsoever to the jury. Don't want them to hear about them because they're not reliable. It's not something that is that should be heard because it might be prejudicial. It's not evidence that is really well supported in fact. So that might go into the
maybe category. A red herring, just take you off on a rabbit trail somewhere. It's not
that might go in your motion in limine.
Yeah,
because we don't want that to come up at any point in time during jury selection or anything. But then there might be several other issues that we're just aware of, and if they come up, then we're ready to object, and we're ready for our, you know, to articulate our basis of whatever the objection is. So that's just a decision of the both attorneys as it relates to that. Then when you get to the actual trial itself, obviously the jury selection process is pretty interesting.
Right.
You know, what you're doing in this process, which is called voir dire, is first of all the plaintiff's attorney is going to go first, the party with the burden of proof, and then the defendant second. Is you're trying to make sure that you don't have jurors who know any of the parties, who know the witnesses, who have some past relationship, a professional relationship, you know, whatever with one of the attorneys. You know, you're just trying to find unbiased group of jurors to hear this evidence and make a determination based on the law,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to based on, you know, doing someone a favor, you know, those kind of things.
It's, you know, the question of jury of peers is one that I think a lot of people say, well, really, is that, does that really have any meaning, or is it just simply that they're citizens and you're and that's as far as it goes, as far as the jury of your peers?
Well, I mean, they are. I mean, you know, it's, I've never really thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Jury of your peers, you know, it's people in your community in most cases, people
mm-hmm.
in your locale, people in that are, you know, walk, talking. Or,
yeah, I know for decades people right. have argued that maybe we should have professional jurors.
Right, right.
And I disagree with that. I think that this is the job of the attorneys to put this in language that the jury can understand
right.
and act on.
Right. That is the cornerstone of our system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what it's all about, to be able to get an unbiased group of people who are in this community or in the general locale where the case is being tried. And, you know, you don't know them. They don't know you.
Mm-hmm.
They come from all walks of life. They have different biases, opinions, so on and so forth. You have the right to kind of vet that out because,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have the jury selection process. And you don't have to worry about politics there.
Right.
You don't have to worry about, you know, any type of influence that you may feel would otherwise be present
mm-hmm.
on the bench, even though, you know, that probably would not be present. So, you know, having professional jurors would just be, you know, that's just something I can't even get my mind wrapped around,
yeah.
really. You know?
Yeah, I think so, some other countries do it, but it does seems to be just antithetical to our whole
no
idea.
No doubt, no doubt.
So that jury selection, though, mm-hmm. Does a judge place limits on how long that can go? I mean, does it tell you move along?
Yeah. Judges are normally very patient with regard to jury selection.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to keep you within a certain box as it relates to the questions you can ask.
Mm-hmm.
You can't ask stakeout questions where you get too detailed as it relates to what you're asking jurors, meaning you
mm-hmm.
don't want to get into the particular issues in the case. Now, you can ask things, you know, around the case. You can,
right.
you know, for example, let's say that one of the issues is whether the person who had been diagnosed with dementia had the capacity to sign the will.
Mm-hmm.
You can ask questions like, have you ever dealt with someone who has diminished capacity?
Right.
You know, have you, go through work history? I mean, you know, obviously we might want to know if someone ever worked in a nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone who may have legal experience, medical experience, these kind of things. More broad, general questions to find out who the people are,
right.
Who the person is as a prospective juror. But you can't get into those details.
More to come in a moment here on Let's Talk Legal. If you have a question you've always wanted to ask about the trial process, you can give us a call now or any of your other legal questions at 247-7282. We'll be back with Wes Collins in just a moment. And we're back with the Wes Collins from Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law, online at harvellandcollins.com, where you can listen to past shows as well. We have Mike and Hubert on with us to ask a question. Hi, Mike. How are you?
All right. Look, I was going to know what type of lawyer do you get to sue, like Department of Social Services?
Okay, well,
for negligence.
Yeah, what's the issue with regard to the Department of Social Services?
Yeah, what's your issue?
It's the Child Protective Division, I guess. The issue?
Well,
it's go ahead.
No, great question. There's probably a lot of detail behind that.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of lawyer? I think you would need someone who has litigation experience. I mean, first of all, so a litigator, I would say, as opposed to like a real estate attorney, transactional attorney.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that someone who has experience in dealing with
DSS.
The DSS, yeah. Which would be, it could be someone who has family law experience. It's kind of sounding like if it's, as you said, Child Protective Services, someone who deals with family law issues beyond just, you know, standard divorces.
Are you looking to appeal a decision?
No, it's a little more than that. They're supposed to operate on an anonymity, an anonymity situation. Like, say, I do something, I call them, say, such and such is doing such and such.
Right.
Okay. Right. And they're supposed to operate in an anonymity kind of situation. They're not supposed to tell them who I am.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right. So you're saying that happened, huh?
Well, without going into a lot of details about it, you know, I gave him a situation, and I said, do not say anything about these pictures.
Right, okay.
I told him I had pictures. Do not tell them about these pictures, because when you do, I said, they are going to know it was me.
Right.
Yeah. Right? And they went right to him within hours and told him about pictures, and now the crap has hit the fan, and I am severely, like, and again, it's something I have to, you know, sit down and talk with somebody about.
Yeah.
You know, I'm feeling like I've been wronged, like maximum. They're negligent in their operations. They should have never done that. There was other ways around it.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, what I would recommend with regard to that is you're on the right track. Get together with someone who is going to be able to handle this through the right channels. So your question is certainly appropriate. And I would say that, you know, someone who really is a litigator and who deals with these issues of confidentiality through government agencies such as DSS. Mm-hmm. So that's
who would that be? I mean, where do I go?
I tell you what.
Can you point me in the right direction?
Well, I tell you what. Why don't you call me off the air today?
That'd be great.
And 72 the standard number that we give, 726-9050, and that's a 252 area code. Okay.
Okay.
And then I need to give that a little bit of thought about who might be able to help you. All right,
Mike. Go ahead. And
what time can I call?
I'll be in the office all day today, or most of the day, from what I recall. And if you don't get me, leave a voicemail with your number. I will call you back.
All right.
Well, okay. What's the earliest I can call?
I'll be in at about 8:30.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mike. When you get, obviously, you get some emotional situations,
sure,
you have to have that third party. You've got to have somebody else who can speak on your behalf and move things forward. And sometimes it needs to move quickly.
So. That's right. No doubt. Yeah. So if he has a good question there, we just need to get him with the right person so that it can be handled in the correct manner.
And when you're trying to take an action against a governmental agency, it's a whole different ball of wax.
Well, you've got sovereign immunity issues. Yeah. Not so much here. I mean, you know, but you have a lot of different issues you have to deal with. If you're talking about a breach of a statute or confidentiality requirement under a statute, in many cases you've got a remedy that is statutory as well. So there are many cases, limitations on what you can do. I mean, it's not like we can, you know, just go sue the government.
Contract, yeah.
Yeah, they're not going to sue the government. They're going to write you a big check because you're upset. I mean, there's protocol here, and there are procedures that you need to go through in order to deal with these things.
And
Mike's
situation,
and in Mike's situation is, you know, you can't unring the bell as well. I mean, he's been tainted in his mind. You know, this has affected him and his relationship with his family or whomever these people are, and you can't undo that.
Right.
So I can understand why that would make him very upset. But again,
seeking accountability,
getting with the right person
is
incredibly important. Yep.
All right. Well, we'll take a short break. We'll come back with more here on Let's Talk Legal with Harbell and Collins, Attorneys at Law. And now you can reach us at 247-7282. Hey, welcome back to the program here. Wes Collins with us from Harvell and Collins. You can go online at harvellandcollins.com and listen to past shows as well. So we're at jury selection.
Yeah, we're walking through the process of you know, an actual jury trial, and we were kind of at the beginning of it when we had a good call from Mike and went through his issue there a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the jury selection process, the plaintiff side is going to have the opportunity to go first. You're asking the questions about the jurors or prospective jurors that are called into the box. You know, you might have 50 people or 100 people there, and then there's, for example, 12 in the box, and you're asking the questions to those who are in the box.
Are you going one by one, or are you just...
I normally am going to ask questions that would apply to the entire group first. Ask for, you know, a show of hands on particular questions. That moves things along a little bit.
Yeah.
But then I do follow up with a one-by-one question process in most cases. Just depending on what the case is, going through different things with folks. Then you have the right to strike jurors in the event that they're jurors that you don't believe would be able to serve well on this particular jury for whatever reason. You have the right, without any cause whatsoever, to strike. Your typical situation is eight. So you have eight peremptory strikes. So let's say that I go through the voir dire, the questioning, and I strike four. Well, then four are called into the box. Well, then since I've stricken four and I'm now only asking questions of the new four, the other eight I passed on. Okay, so now I'm just limited to my questions of the four that I brought in. So let's say that I'm okay with those four. So I pass on the jury. I'm okay with the panel. I'll report that to the court. It then goes to the defense side, and they go through their process. So that kind of goes back and forth like a tennis match until we're at a point where we have where both sides are satisfied with the jury panel. But you can only use eight strikes without cause. Now, you might have situations that come up. For example, when we were trying the case before Christmas, my associate, Sam Morris, his aunt was, I think, the very first one that was called up.
No kidding.
So, you know, instead of dancing around that issue, I immediately made the court aware of it. And we all agreed that she could take a step down for call. So
that wasn't a strike.
That wasn't one of my eight. Right, I wouldn't have a problem if his aunt was on the jury. So I don't want to take don't take one of my strikes. But nevertheless, so we all agreed, you know, that she could step down. They called a new one, and then I started the process with the 12. So, you know, that's a very important process. How long does that take? Sometimes it takes an hour. Sometimes it takes 6 hours. I mean, you just don't know. It's depending on, you know, how the attorneys handle it.
So. Okay. Listen next week for more on the process here, too, as we are talking about your legal life with Harvell and Collins. You can go online at harvellandcollins.com, and you can also give them a call and ask your questions about your legal life, too. And you can set up that appointment at 252-726-9050. That's what